Hello everyone and welcome back to the Forgecast. My name is Alex Norton and I have with me a repeat guest, Master Smith Kyle Royer. How you doing, Kyle?
I'm doing great. Absolutely fantastic.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming on the show. I'll just say a word from our sponsors and then we'll get straight into it. Today's Forgecast is brought to you by Robert Weber Abrasives. So hit them up at webers.net.au the next time you're stocking up. And while you're shopping, make sure to visit nordicedge.com.au for the best supply of knife making tools, steels, and other materials around, shipping Australia wide and abroad. So due to some unforeseen personal reasons, Sam will be taking some time away from the show for a while. But we do actually have a heap of wonderful guests lined up over the coming weeks and we'll be maintaining our regular schedule. So feel free to shoot Sam some words of encouragement, but he's doing all right. He's a tough fella. And you'll see him back here eventually. Don't worry about that. But in the meantime, we have the pleasure of being joined by somebody who has not actually been on the show for almost 3 years. Can you believe it?
Long, long time. I was thinking it was like 2 years, but yeah, you pointed out 3 years. And I can't believe it.
Well, it's funny because I think it was 2020 they were calling the year that never was, because the pandemic sort of made everything just sort of fly by because everything was not working properly. So it makes sense. It would seem like it never happened.
That must be why I'm thinking 2 years in my mind.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll get into what you've been up to this week. I'll just run through the shenanigans I've been up to. Mostly I've been working on a pair of stainless liner locks just to refine my understanding of the mechanism. And I've been closely studying the work of some of my biggest liner lock or frame lock influences, such as Charles Pinard and Jason Allen at Lindblade. And they come together really good. I really wanted them to have the nice sort of flip action that you can do one-handed. And I'm really, really liking the mechanism. I'm templating everything so that I can make them again in the future. And I've also been working on my big folding knife project at the moment, Tusk, which is at the slow methodical detail stage. All the sort of hogging work's done, and now it's just that sitting at a bench hunched over with an optimizer on stage of the work. And a good exciting thing, everyone knows I'm finally getting a mill, hopefully this week, but next week I'm getting a fly press delivered, which I'm really excited about. I do have a hydraulic press, but my forge has no power in it. It's completely off grid, just because I just live far too remote to be able to reach it to where that shed is. So I've been having to use petrol driven presses, which is difficult and noisy and smelly and awful. So having a big old-fashioned fly press is as a force multiplier, especially considering I usually work with small billets, is going to be a game changer for me. And it'll help, you know, sort of like a gym membership too. I'll be really buff.
That
on
is
one
gonna
side.
Be such a workout, man. I've seen some guys running those things and making Damascus, and they're just sitting there like going crazy. Don't knock yourself off with like the counterweight on it or whatever.
Oh,
yourself out.
One of the best knife makers in Australia is a young fella called Jason Allard, which he lives on the same little island that I do. And seeing him use a fly press, man, the kid would weigh like 80 pounds soaking wet, but he throws himself at that thing, doing like 8-inch thick billets of mosaic Damascus on it and everything, and he pulls it off. But I look at it and I think, how do you get your energy? He makes me feel so old.
I worked with him while I was in Australia. We did the 1 week long master class on mosaic Damascus, and he's super high energy all the time. You should see him run a regular powered hammer. Like, he just runs it at 1,000%.
I was watching videos of him at the Blade Symposium doing flips off anvils and things. To be 20 again, it'd be great. I hurt my back just watching videos of him using the fly press, but
Oh man. Yeah. So how big is the fly press you're getting?
It's I believe a number 8. So what's that be, like 8 ton, I suppose.
Okay.
But that's when you're sort of using it casually. I think if you throw yourself at them, you can sort of get a couple extra tonnage out of it. Nice. But yeah, like I said, I do fairly small billets. I think the tallest billet I've ever made was 2 inches tall. I'm not a big fan of super high layer Damascus. I usually stop about 200, 240 layers maximum. So I only need to do a few folds to get there. And I'm not a fan of mosaics and things yet. Who knows, in the future I might change, but usually I'll do fairly simple patterns like twists and laddering. So it'll be good, and it'll fit with the powerless sort of decor of my forge setup. So it's the sort of thing, you don't need batteries or power to be able to, or fuel to run a fly press. You just need to have your Wheaties in the morning. That's all.
There's got to be some kind of satisfaction you get out of making a billet of Damascus without using any kind of powered press or anything. I know that's got to give it at least a little extra satisfaction once you get that done.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of people like to give me a lot of hell for it, but I get as much as I can out of a billet. Sam sent me for my birthday, it was either last year or the year before, he sent me a 3-pound billet of just straight layer Damascus with alternating thickness of layers. It was about 190 layers, and I still have some of that left, enough for about 2 more knives. Because I only make folding knives, and I tend to sand my billets, I'll usually put a monosteel core because I'm not a fan of Damascus on the cutting edge, just in my style. So it just makes the billets go even further and further.
Oh, yeah.
And, I'm notoriously cheap when it comes to Damascus. So if I spend a week working on this a really heckin' billet, I can get a lot of knives out of it. So it's not something I'll use super often, but when I do, I think I'll be glad for it.
Now, earlier you mentioned you're working on 2 folders with stainless steel blades.
That's right. It's 14C28N, which I believe is almost identical to Oz-8 steel.
Okay. So have you done much with stainless before? Because that's something I actually would like to get into a little bit myself, is working with some stainless blades.
This is me journeying into it. I'm actually in the process of building a heat treatment kiln from scratch, because my background's in electrical engineering, or one of my backgrounds. So I wanted to be able to work with stainless steels, and a kiln is very sort of crucial to that. But until then, to get practice with it, I needed a stainless steel that would be okay to be able to do decent heat treats with by hand in a gas forge and with no heat treatment sort of precision abilities. And 14C28N has very, very simple, forgiving heat treatment process at the cost of only ever being able to maybe get a Rockwell of like 56 out of it if you really push it. So okay. it's decent but not great, especially since I'm used to working with 1084 is my all-time favorite steel, just because it's so forgiving and so versatile. It's working with the stainless, you get, you know, benefits of stainless. As Niels Vandenberg always says, it's stainless, not stain never. But people tend to abuse knives, probably not your knives, Carl, because yours are want to be put behind glass, but
You'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
But the 14C28N has been lovely to work with, and I imagine if you do have a heat treatment oven, you'd be able to get possibly even for a cryo, if you have the ability to do basic cryo, you'd be able to squeeze those extra couple of Rockwell points out of it. I've just got a gas forge and a freezer, but it's it held up to being batoned into mild steel and scraping shavings off mild steel, and it holds up to a brass rod test, and that's good enough for me for a pocket knife.
Nice. That sounds really great. That's exciting to hear that you're having success with it, because I want to get into doing stainless, and I even want to try doing like a stainless Damascus or something at some point and see how that goes.
I was actually talking to Jack Connon from South Africa, if you're familiar with him. He made a ring recently out of stainless Damascus that he used, I think it was 316 and 416 together, stainless. And when he did an etch process on them, the contrast in the etch was phenomenal. Now, these are both non-martensitic stainless steels, but he said the weld process is fairly straightforward, and the contrast that you get in the etch is incredible. So if you were to jacket those around something like a stainless edge of 14C28N or VG10 or something like that, you'd be able to get a very high contrast Damascus.
Ooh, that's what I would be going for sure. As much contrast as possible.
Absolutely. But I mean, if you want to talk about doing stainless Damascus, Jason Ellard, who we were talking about before, has done incredible work with it, and he's very talented in the realm of that. And he does it with such a basic setup. It's amazing what he's able to achieve.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, I didn't know he did any stainless Damascus.
Yeah, he's sort of pioneered it in Australia, as far as I'm aware. He's doing things that you're not supposed to be able to do with that basic setup, but he pulled it off with a fly press and a gas forge, and he got incredible contrast with it. And I mean, the key is just when you get your steel layers flat, you want to get them flatter, and when you get it hot, you want to get it hotter, and when you want to seal off the oxygen, you want to get just no oxygen in there, as much as possible removed. Some people even slide little bits of paper inside their sealed billets so that when it heats up, it burns off any oxygen that might be residual inside there and things like that. So if you're going to put sheet steel on the side, you might slip some paper in the sides or something. But that's pretty much it. And even then, it's still a bit risky to do it. But this is just my very amateur understanding of it after forge welding billets of carbon steel Damascus for years. It's new territory to me. So,
yeah. I think I'm on the road to like slowly getting towards that kind of thing more and more in the future anyway, because I'm already starting to like seal my billets up with sheet metal and stuff like that. So I think I'm on the right track to slowly evolving into trying out some stainless Damascus maybe.
That's right. I would definitely reach out to Jason and Jack Connon. They'd be able to, and both the wonderful to talk to about their craft, and Jack Connon in particular is very giving with his knowledge, so he's definitely someone to talk to about it, and probably love to hear from you, to be honest.
Nice. Yeah, I might have to reach out to him then.
So my song of the week is actually from a band called The Black Keys, which I'd never heard of before until I started playing Guitar Hero, and then one of their songs came up, and I loved it. It's a new band, recent band, but they have this old sort of deep south blues, like grungy blues sound that is from a world that's gone now, but they seem to have held on to this sound, and it's just incredible the amount of soul that they have in there. And so look at them, you'd never think that this sound would come out of these people, but it does. And the song of theirs that I've been listening to is called Heavy Soul. Heavy Soul. It's just, if you like blues and you like old-fashioned sort of New Orleans-style street blues, it's the sort of thing that you just want to close your eyes and tilt your head back and just feel it and let it envelop you. It's definitely something to have listened to. I know I've been putting a lot of blues on the ForgeCast playlist recently, but I'm in a blues kick. What can I say?
Nice. You know somebody else who always has blues on in the background every time I see like one of his Instagram videos?
Yeah.
Dave Lish.
Yeah.
He always seems to have like some classic blues going on. It's pretty cool.
We had him on the show, and he added Fast Hand by Cody Jinks onto the ForgeCast playlist. I had never heard of Cody Jinks, and I've been obsessed with him ever since. Such good country blues music, like really very Americana style sound to it. And thanks to Dave, I've been listening to Cody a lot.
So did you say you ran into the Black Keys by playing Guitar Hero?
Yeah, their song Next Girl was on, I think, Guitar Hero 5.
Okay.
And Next
That's
Girl
really cool.
is a great song. But I'm not very sort of in the music scene. I don't go to concerts. I don't listen to the radio even, because it's all filled with ads and horrible other things that I don't like listening to. So I tend to basically just have I even still use an old MP3 player. Nobody uses that anymore. They all use Spotify and all this sort of thing, which suggests new music too. So I don't really get exposed to new music a lot. And so I find it in weird places. So I'll be in a shop and I'll hear something come over the speakers in the shop, and I'll whip out my Shazam app on my phone and be like, this is cool. And then I'll explore their catalog and that sort of thing. So I find songs in weird ways, and Guitar Hero was was what got me onto the Black Keys.
That's really cool that it that you found it like the Guitar Hero 5. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, that's right. But what about you, Carl? What have you been up to this week?
Well, this week has been the first of the month. So we have Knife Maker Plus, where we're doing courses every month that we release. And we basically set aside the very first week of the month, or maybe a little more time than that sometimes, depends on how long it takes to video whatever. And we just work on whatever that project is for a solid week, week and a half, or whatever. So I've been working on the Enigma folder, which is our current project.
Yeah.
The last 2 days, I mean, they weren't glorious at all. I was actually really having a hard time just figuring out a way to flatten these titanium liners for the folder. It's really big. It's like a 5-inch handle, 5 1/4 or something.
And titanium's got some trickiness to work with.
Yeah, and I've done some little folders in the past, like a lot of them, but the titanium I was using was like perfectly flat already, but this stuff needed flattened. And I kept bouncing around trying different things, and I was messing with it yesterday and a bunch today. Finally got it. Went from using a surface grinder attachment like on a 2x72 to using my actual surface grinder with the piece like CA glued down to a piece of metal, but it was like digging into it really weird and burning, and using a disc sander and rubbing on it by hand on paper and the milling machine. I tried everything, but I finally got it flat. Working on that blade, getting the blade all surface ground down, getting everything to the final thicknesses so I can start milling counter sinks and stuff for the bearings that are going to go in there. So just been doing a lot of this fun kind of precise folder stuff that I really enjoy that I haven't done in many, many years. But it's really fun to get back into it and be doing a folder and just kind of relearning the things and teaching different stuff as I go discovering. There's just like a bunch of discovery in it, because sometimes knife making can become like, if monotonous. You do the same thing or something similar over and over again, it just becomes lose some a of the challenge almost. In it.
Yeah.
And that challenge, that new challenging thing every once in a while really is fun if you have time to explore that route.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. So
that's been really fun / frustrating, depending on how you look at it.
While we're talking about reaching out to people, you definitely need to talk to Jason Allen at Lindblade, if you don't follow him already, L-I-N-D Blade. We had him on the show, and he almost exclusively uses titanium in his folding knives, and he does some of the most precise work I've ever seen in folding knives. His attention to detail is just next level.
Wow. Like, I'll definitely look him up.
Yeah, and titanium's his bag. He's great with it, so he'd probably have lots of cool tips.
Nice. What style of folders does he normally make?
Sort of very modern liner lock style folders that are very sort of... there's that sort of old world look to folding knives, and then there's the sort of tactical style modern look to it. He's very much the modern look, but his use of aesthetic is... We had him on the show to talk about it, because he'll do things like coining on the liners will line up perfectly with the jimping on the back of the knife in both the open and closed states. So the flow lines will work and can have continuity between the different parts of the blade, depending on whether despite whether it's open or closed. And his precision and attention to detail was unlike anything we'd ever seen. In things that don't need to be that precise, which is why it's so impressive, because he needs it to be. And he's also an absolute gem of a human being. After getting him on the show and talking to him, he's just delightful. He's lovely.
Awesome. Those little details like that, you're saying the jimping on the file work and stuff all lining up when the blades open and close, that stuff, when you see that, it just gives you this, when you notice it, it gives you this special feeling inside. It's like, oh, somebody really thought this out. Because that like doesn't happen on its own very often.
It's like when you find something that perfectly fits into something else, and you just sort of think, ooh, it feels nice to watch that happen.
Yep. Yeah, you can actually get a little shiver from it, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But do you have a song that you wanted to add to the...
Yeah, my song of the week that I've listened to a couple times is... this week I've listened to it a lot, actually, overall, by Metallica, which is big band that's not...
Yeah, some people may have heard of them.
Well, I say that because I actually discovered Metallica when I was 28 years old, and I'm 31 now.
Right.
So I grew up listening to like really conservative music and stuff, and So I discovered Metallica, went out and bought a guitar and all that, and became a big fan because I love their riffs mostly. Yeah. The song is "The Day That Never Comes."
Yeah, right.
It's really long. I think it's like 7 or 8 minutes or something, but it's got like so many different kind of tempo changes, and there's a couple different solos in it, and it's got some really calm melodic stuff and then some really aggressive, harder stuff in it. And I just love the whole thing, the whole mix together.
Yeah. Brilliant. Similar sort of vibe to their song One, very long, but has that build and contrast between different parts of the song.
Yes.
If you've only just recently discovered Metallica, have you discovered Apocalyptica yet?
Apocalyptica?
Apocalyptica. They're a cover band that do Metallica songs using classical instruments.
I have not.
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down right now.
It's all cellos and things. Particularly, their cover of the song Nothing Else Matters is hauntingly beautiful.
Wow.
It has Nothing just as much matters. In... Nothing Else Matters is probably one of the most famous Metallica songs ever, and it's very intense, but for different reasons to Apocalyptica's version of Nothing Else Matters. The crescendo at the end of it, when the solo would normally happen, you listen to it and it just sends chills down your spine hearing it played on cellos and upright basses and things. It's just incredible. But when they perform in concerts, they still have all the black clothes and the chains and the long hair, and they're still... headbanging and that, but playing cellos. It's incredible.
I'll definitely have to check that out because, Nothing Else Matters seems like it would be a really good song to have some different instruments like that.
Absolutely. That's good. I don't think we actually have Metallica on the playlist yet, and we might, but it's very eclectic. We've got everything from violin concertos to... children's songs to musical scores from Greece and things like that. It's wild. But after 3 years, you add one or two different songs to it.
Nice. Yeah, I've heard that it was kind of eclectic. So I tried to pick one of my favorite like songs that I listened to a lot that wasn't like one of the top hits or something too.
Yep,
absolutely. Like Enter Sandman.
Yep. Oh, that drum riff, though. That'll get your handstand rhythm going.
That's what got me into guitar. Like, I heard that song I discovered it on YouTube, and I'm like, that sounds so amazing. I need to be able to make this sound in my house.
Yes, that's right. Oh, man. We were talking about you were last on the show 3 years ago, a long time ago, and back then you were already a mastersmith. How have you sort of developed since then? What kind of cool new stuff have you learned in these 3 years? How have you progressed as a knife maker?
Oh, boy. I would say the progression has definitely slowed down a lot. It's like, I think at first it's easier to like make really big leaps and bounds that are easy to see from the outside. And then the longer you do something, the more the changes and the progression really starts to get smaller and subtle as you're trying to perfect different aspects of whatever craft you're doing.
It's like doing the same stuff, but doing it better and more refined.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the changes have definitely been small over the last couple of years compared to what I was used to. Like when I first was testing for journeyman and all that kind of stuff, it seemed like the changes would happen overnight sometimes with like not being able to weld Damascus to like, being able to, stuff like that.
Yeah, make mistakes and things.
Over the last couple of years, I would say the biggest changes have actually been in things that aren't really knife making, more like working with YouTube, teaching, and doing classes and videos and working with my family better and all that stuff. Knife making has progressed, but it's been... probably behind all those other things in a way. One of the main things that I think has progressed in knife making is finishes and fit ups and stuff. Fit and finish has gotten better and changed. I've always been on this like journey to find the ultimate contrast in my Damascus, always experimenting with that. That's gotten to a place that it's I'm pretty happy with it right now. And I'm not chasing it as hard as I used to be. So that's kind of changed over the last couple of years. Because I think 3 years ago, I might have just been dabbling in like the whole coffee dark and finish and stuff. And I've been experimenting with it for 3 years now.
I know you probably don't watch my YouTube videos or have time to even, but I did after a long discussion on the ForgeCast with Sam about coffee etching. I sort of started having questions pop into my head about, you know, everyone accepts the way that coffee etching works, but is there a way to potentially get higher contrast with it? And so I ended up doing this long video experiment that lasted 4 or 5 days, and edited it together, obviously, but trying to see whether or not we could push the contrast that you can get from coffee etching. And what we found was quite strange, actually. Preparing coffee with cold water and then putting high manganese steel in it and then leaving it for a couple of days to eat that steel almost primed the coffee and it etched darker.
Really?
It was very strange, the results that we got from it.
Primed the coffee.
It's almost okay, like so you feeding a sourdough, you know? It's like
you put a separate piece in there and let it sit for a couple of days, then put your blade in.
That's right. I made multiple jugs of coffee. I made one with cold water. I made one with room temperature water, one with hot water from the tap, one with boiled water from the kettle. I did ones where I was actually putting 1084 steel in there, and then every day I would take it out, polish the surface again, and then put it back in to remove the oxides. I was doing pH testing on it to see whether or not the acidity would go up or down. And and then at the end, we finally did contrasting etches of identically prepared pieces of 1084 steel. And the one that etched by far noticeably darkest was one that was prepared cold, left for 3 or 4 days by feeding it with bits of polished 1084 during those 4 days. And it etched much, much darker.
That's so cool. So is that like the method you're using now on your regular blades?
It is, yeah. If I need to work fast, I'll still prepare it with hot water from the tap. Actually prepared coffee better than boiled water, so I'll use that if I need to just to quickly make it etch something and then move on. But if I want those crisp darks now, I use that full method. I do point out in the video, though, that was using one particular brand of instant coffee, and I don't know whether or not changing brands would change results. So it was to try and encourage people to play around with the one that they use and see, and not just accept that this is as dark as I can get it with the coffee. But it was shocking, the difference that it's very, very noticeable.
That sounds really cool. I've seen a few of your videos. I have not seen that one. I'll definitely have to look it up and watch it. I am always coffee darkening, getting that finish perfected. I'm always on the pursuit of trying to get it better and better, so I'd love to see that for sure.
Yeah, I've actually had a lot of people request a follow-up, because I mean, as far as the scientific experiment goes, there was a little bit of sloppiness in the controls and all that sort of thing. I'd like to actually get thermometers out and gauge temperatures and really make everything as precise as possible to see whether or not I can get it even better. I'd like to have fixed instructions and maybe try like a dozen different brands of instant coffee and see if there are better types. Everyone assumes it's the phosphoric acid that's in the coffee, but there's actually about 12 different kinds of acids in instant coffee.
12? Whoa.
So we don't really know what type it is.
Oh, wow. It'd be cool if we could somehow locate what is actually doing the, you know, darkening the way we want it to, and just get that and then put our blade into it and get it even better.
I mean, there are people at the moment that are doing etch contrast increases using orange juice, warm orange juice.
Really?
And that's citric acid. So who knows? There's more research required there. So it's cool that you're pushing the extents of that, because there's definitely still extents to be pushed for sure.
The biggest thing that I've found out over the last couple of years that's helped me get the coffee darkening finish to like stick a lot better and more consistent is when I first started out, I would polish my blades after the ferric chloride etch. I would sand them with like 3000 grit quite a bit to get rid of all the black oxides completely. And sometimes I would even buff the blades so they would be chatoyant and then put them in the coffee. But I noticed the really large areas of 1084 that were kind of highly polished, even though they were down below the 15 and 20, seemed to not let the coffee stick as well. Mm. So I've been like doing a little like 2 or 3, maybe 5 minute etch in the ferric chloride right before I put it in the coffee and immediately put it in there without sanding that, sanding any of those oxides off. And it seems to leave more of this
like a crust,
frosted texture or something. Yeah. Like a crust on the 1084 that the coffee can then adhere to better or something. And it doesn't seem to rub off as much when I'm using my sunshine cloth and all that.
Yeah. Right. I've noticed that, the Artificery, do you follow him on Instagram?
Yes. Yeah. He does stainless Damascus.
And some of the contrast he gets is incredible. He never shows his technique. I'd be interested to talk to him. Maybe we should reach out, try and get him on the show.
Yeah. Yep. He does some amazing, amazing contrast. And then his stainless Damascus, like feather pattern stainless and stuff, mm-hmm. I think he's done.
It's just insanity.
Yeah.
But with great risk comes great reward, as I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you were actually mentioning the Knife Maker Plus and online courses that you've been doing. They've been doing the rounds and they look phenomenal. How's the experience been for you? Because you've gone from working very much working on your own to then working with your family, but then interacting with all, it's almost like bringing other people into your world. All these people doing the course, they have this insight and they're seeing you all the time. And now you're taking on such a teaching role and things. How's that changed things for you?
It's been really challenging sometimes to like, especially dedicate time to producing Knife Maker Plus every month and setting aside whatever project I'm working on the rest of the month, like shifting focus to work on this new project and try to teach it really well. It's been a big challenge. And then like my regular projects feeling like they're taking even longer. I put this expectation on myself to where these things need to get done in a certain time. And it just feels like it's taking way longer, even though it's not taking longer to make the knife. It's just getting drawn out more because there's more things going on all at once.
Yeah.
And then working with the family and stuff, the first year and a half were definitely the most challenging. As we're all working here longer and longer, we kind of understand each other's like quirks at work more. I mean, because we were all close at home when I lived at home for many years, but it's different when you're actually working with your family. So just understanding what like ticks each person off has been really, really helpful to figure out. And teaching things has been really challenging to try to figure out how to try to efficiently teach people things without trying to like repeating myself too many times just to drill it in people's heads, not knowing how many times I need to reinforce what I'm saying sometimes. Because if you go to school or something, like you're told some of the same things over and over and over and over again for many years. So I sometimes have a tendency of like saying the same thing like 5 times. Yep. And Josh will have to edit a couple of them out because it's just too much. And then it ends up just taking too long while we're out there shooting to do all that. So figuring all that dynamic has been really weird.
Been putting out some online courses myself. And one of the things that I find the most challenging is things that you are just so used to doing and are just intrinsic to you, trying to actually then have to explain it to somebody from the perspective of somebody that has never seen that technique before can sometimes, it sometimes be hard to actually, you don't think of the steps that you take to do it. You just do it. And so all of a sudden you're in this position where you've got to show somebody how to do it and then where they're expected to then be able to do it afterwards. And it can be quite challenging sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And then you get a question. It's like, how do you do such and such? And I'm like, I didn't even mention how to do that, I guess, because I was just kind of assuming that you go from this point to this point and forgot the middle.
Yep. I mean, it's true though, that teaching can make you a better maker. Because it starts sometimes the odd questions that you get or having to actually break down a process into something you'd normally do quickly, but then it takes a lot longer to stage it out and film it and explain it. You start questioning your own choices. It's like, well, why do I do it this way? I could just do it like this, but you'd never thought about it before. So it's a good way to refine your own technique, to be honest.
Definitely. You have to think about stuff that you totally wouldn't have thought of before, because like conveying what you're doing to somebody is just, it can be so hard sometimes.
Yeah. We like to have our guests talk about people who influence them. And you're talking about teaching, and sometimes people get taught by people without them even realizing it. Usually those people come through as our influences. When at least when I think of you, and I'm sure many of my listeners will agree, when we think of you, we think of one of the best knife makers in the world. I'm not trying to inflate your ego here. It's just pretty much fact. Just look at your work. So when we think of somebody that's influencing you, that's somebody that's worth knowing about. So who has been a big influence of yours that you'd like to actually shout out a reference to? Someone who's sort of taught you something, even if you've never met them before.
Well, currently, one of my biggest influences, I would say, is Jeff Park. Mm-hmm. He's on Instagram at j.park1. That's Park with an E at the end. And he does engraving. And I absolutely love his engraved work. He does tons of gold inlay and stuff. And I dabble in a little engraving here and there, and that's something I really want to get better at. So I'm continually looking at all these different engravers and stuff. And I just love the style of engraving he does on a lot of his watches and stuff. Tons of gold, really cool geometric patterns, just all inlaid with really sparkling shading and stuff. And it's very, very small and like really tastefully done.
Yeah.
And he's somebody that actually, I think he just opened up his own teaching studio, but he teaches a lot too. He's gone to GRS and taught there and done classes all over the place. And so he's currently somebody that I'm always looking at, like every post he posts, and like trying to analyze and study every little bit of engraving he shows publicly. And
yeah,
just thinking that it's so cool, and it would be so cool to be able to get to that point someday. So he's definitely one of my biggest inspirations currently.
That's great. I mean, it's funny how, one of the things I love about knife making is you could literally double in skill every year, and on your deathbed, you'd still have more to learn. And it's a great feeling when you get into a point where you're comfortable with everything, and then you choose a thing. I want to be uncomfortable in this now. And then you just sort of throw yourself at this thing and start challenging yourself and testing yourself. And it feels all new again. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. There's just so many different things, because with some arts and crafts, they're really great, but they don't have as many different avenues, I feel like, you can go down with knife making. There's just so many different things you can explore. Like, you can look at somebody like Lynn Ray, who really has been going down forging everything to exact shape and forging like integral guards and frames and everything onto his knives, and just getting so precise in that one little aspect of knife making. And it's just so cool and inspiring to see that you can go that far down one little avenue that knife making kind of leads to.
Yeah. Sometimes he'll show a full-size Bowie blade, and says, fresh out of the forge. And I'm like, no way that hasn't been touched to a grinder. Seriously?
Yeah.
Yep.
No, yeah, if I made a knife like that, it would have been like, and I said fresh out of the forge, it would have been like, I don't know, milled out of a big block or something, and then like stuck in the forge to get some scale. And I'm like, here, this is fresh out of the forge.
Oh, the beautiful thing about Lynn is that he does things that you look at and you think, no way is that at all physically possible, but then he's just so willing to turn up at events and teach and show people, and he will do it right in front of them. And I think that's mm-hmm. the only way you could ever fully believe it, is to watch it happen in front of you.
Yeah.
The man's a magician, an absolute magician, and a gentleman too.
Yes. Yep. He's so kind and soft-spoken. It's a pleasure talking with him anytime you can.
Yeah, absolutely. He was one of our inspirations of the week a few weeks back, and another public announcement about him. His Instagram profile did actually get hacked recently, and he created the original one. He's just created a new account, and it doesn't have enough followers, so people need to jump over there. His new account is Lynn_Ray_Knifemaker. So definitely. Definitely make sure you're following his new account, because it's very unfortunate that somebody like that would get hacked. It's been happening a lot lately.
So, yeah.
make sure you turn on two-factor authentication on your Instagram profiles to try and prevent that sort of thing happening, because it does help.
It's so super scary. Even if you follow like all the procedures that you're supposed to, it makes me a little nervous sometimes when I think about it, just Instagram getting hacked or YouTube or something, because you put so much effort into this stuff. You don't want somebody out there just like hacking it and stealing it and trying to make a quick buck off of your followers, you know.
And it's your major avenue for reaching your fan base. So if that's gone, how do you let them know that you're, you know, what you're doing or that you're trying to get it back? It's a bit freaky like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's why getting to know your community matters, because they can help spread the word as quickly as possible. At least say here, not interested in trying to sell you Bitcoin plans. So if I ever am, it's not me. It seems to be the theme.
Uh-huh.
So your dad, Jeff, he's been coming along in such a great way. I think of comparing it to where he was when we first talked to you all those years ago. But now you two seem to be working alongside each other flawlessly. Will we see a big collaborative project of you two in the future?
That needs to happen. That needs to happen. Every once in a while, we talk about some kind of a big collaboration. And just, I think last week, we were actually talking about, like, we need to do something, because we haven't really done any official collaboration yet, just some little tiny side stuff or whatever. But yeah, I don't know, some kind of big, like he does the blade and I do the handle or vice versa kind of thing, because he has come such a long way very quickly. Just today, I think all day, he was working on a sketch for this really cool themed knife that's kind of themed off of a Browning double barrel, like skeet shooting shotgun for shooting clay pigeons and stuff. And it's so cool. It's got this cool like ring guard thing on it that kind of looks like a trigger guard, and this cool shape that'll be carved into the handle that kind of resembles this little shape you find on a lot of gun stocks. And
is he going to checker the handle?
I don't know about that. He did checkering one time so far, and it wasn't a very happy experience for him.
It's enough to drive you mental.
It took so long, and I don't know if he's ready for it, because that wasn't long ago yet.
Yeah, no, I've been loving watching his work, and watching him have such fun with the folders in the recent times was great, because I was going through the same sort of journey at the same time, and then he just outstripped me just so fast, and it was just incredible. And I'm hoping to see more of them from him, to be honest. He's gone a bit quiet on the folders recently, probably working on the Knife Maker Plus content with you.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of chef's knives, and like he's got this buoy going on, and the folders, he was doing the folders because he had a little free time to try something new and wanted to do that, but now he's back on some orders for a while.
Yeah. Oh, you can tell him from me, he was doing phenomenal work. It was just really great to watch. I'd love to try and get him on the show at some point in the future to talk about his work, because he's a great guy. He always makes me laugh in these videos. I love some of the ads that you guys do together. It's just hilarious.
Well, hopefully here on YouTube, we'll have more content that's dad working on projects in the shop, because we actually got a second camera, and they're going to be a different kind of format, but he's been videoing a lot of different stuff, and Josh has only released one video so far, but he's going to have actual knife making videos with voiceover, and Josh will edit them together and everything. So we're excited to see how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, Josh creates just masterful videography for your videos. It's just quite incredible, and it's showing just a window into your workshop is one thing, but showing it so well. Sometimes, I mean, if you're really involved in a project and you're really putting that, you know, like your mum says, sort of putting a spoonful of love into it, because, you know, you have to love this craft to be able to stick with it. Sometimes it's hard to communicate that, but through that sort of beautiful videography, you can really show the beauty of some of the processes with great close-ups and slow motions and things like that, and also communicate just how much work goes into some of these things. But do you have any funny stories of sort of off-camera shenanigans when things have gone a bit crazy?
Off-camera shenanigans. Oh, boy.
Every so often, you'll show bloopers reels in your videos, which I always love at the end. But getting cameras in that close to the equipment's got to lead to some accidents.
I would say one of the most interesting things that happens quite often is I'll be trying to get some kind of point across and I will completely just get tongue-tied right in the middle of a sentence. Like my tongue will just, I don't know, get stuck in my throat or something, and I'll be just like, make some kind of hilarious sound, and then we'll all be like, Dad, Josh, and everybody will just be like laughing like crazy. And it'll take me like a minute to get back on focus. and then, of course, we have all sorts of different times when, like, now that Dad's videoing and we're videoing, Dad'll need to be quiet because I need to say something important, or I'll need to be quiet because Dad's about to say something important. So we always have this like little bit of tension and hilarity happening with that going on.
Yeah.
Nothing too bad's happened with the cameras yet. We've been pretty careful with them. Although Dad's just been videoing for a short time with doing his thing, and he's already like burnt through one or two different lens protectors, I think. Got a few too many sparks on them up close.
Yep. Oh, geez. I mean, it's not cheap equipment to replace sometimes.
Yeah.
Yep. Speaking of your family, your mom seems to just be the supportive heart of the Royer operation, keeping everyone going throughout the days. But yes. Are there any chance that we'll get to see her having a go at making a knife?
I don't know. We've talked about it before. Josh and I both have mentioned, like, Mom, we need to video you making a knife. It would be like a sensational YouTube hit. And every time we mention it, she doesn't seem too interested in getting out there with the sparks and everything.
well, let her know. My wife has actually picked up knife making about 6 months ago. She tried it, and she's actually moved to doing it full time. She's fallen in love with it so much. And,
wow.
She was somebody that had barely used a hand drill before, and now she's grinding knives on a 2x72 and sitting bent over a Fordham for 3 hours straight doing, you know, work with that and things. And there is sometimes, if you just step across the line into the outside your comfort zone, you'll find a hidden
It'll
passion.
Click.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so cool. I'll tell her about that. That sounds, yeah, we need to get her to make a knife. I want to see Mom make a knife. She could even follow one of the courses we have or something, but I'll teach her one-on-one.
Not everybody gets a chance as a one-on-one masterclass with Carl Royer. So, yeah, frame it that way.
Yeah, that would be so much fun.
And I know your dad's was dabbling with the folding knives, and you've got the Knife Maker Plus course with the folding knife that you're doing. And I know you've dabbled with folding knives before, but will we be seeing any of those big Carl Royer masterpieces in the form of a folder anytime in the future?
I hope so, because I always wanted to
Excalibur level folder.
I would love for that to happen, like full on like art knife style folders with really high end embellishments, you know, kind of modern art flares and all sorts of stuff. I'd love to go that direction if I can. I've always wanted to, but kind of orders and what I was known for
is the buoys, kind of daggers and swords.
Yeah, those things have kind of always directed me that direction, and I did 15, 20 folders in a couple year period back in the day, but they never kicked off like the buoys and fighters already were, so that's kind of why they've gone that way. But the folder, that's part of what's great about Knife Maker Plus 2, is it's given me the opportunity to teach tons of different things I know about making Damascus and doing fine fits and finish and stuff. But it's also given me the opportunity to kind of discover and learn all these different things that I don't know about folder making, and things that I've forgotten about folder making, kind of rediscover and learn those things that I normally wouldn't have that opportunity to do. So that's kind of what's exciting about that too.
Yeah.
For me,
absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, I suppose it sort of comes back to what we were saying about how teaching can sometimes make you learn yourself quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a couple of listener emails that we might run through, and Carl, feel free to throw in your opinion on these.
All right.
Yeah, our first one comes from Eduardo Sol, and he says, "Hey guys, would love to hear you guys talk about the determination / discipline required to work for yourself and go after it every single day. I struggle to get into my shop even though I have orders to fill. I use the weather or anything else as an excuse to stay inside and go to bed early instead of going out to my shop. Thanks for the time and awesome podcast." So that's a good question. I mean, sometimes things can get a little hairy, but any thoughts on that, Kyle?
That's actually a really good question, and I have quite a bit of experience in this kind of thing, actually, because I was really bad about procrastinating on projects for many years before I started working with my family. I would have a couple years where I did really well, self-disciplined, get tons of work done and stuff, but then I would have a couple year period sometimes where I almost did nothing in the shop at all. I would just play video games, like literally for a job for almost a 2 year period at one point, I would say. So one of the best things for me was having more responsibilities to take care of, like, and make sure that things operate properly, like owning a house and needing to pay a mortgage and stuff. Yeah. That really helped. Things
eating
like
food.
That. Eating food. Yeah, I'd go pretty long without eating much at all, ramen and stuff. And then getting people around you that you can work with, or that can work with you, and like having my family like join in and become part of this thing we're doing here was a really big one, because now we're all relying on each other to make sure that we all succeed together or fail together or however it goes. But just having all that accountability with each other has been tremendous for me, because without that, it can be really, really hard sometimes if you're completely on your own to just get out in the shop, because like you said, the weather or anything could be an excuse that day to just not get out there. But if you can get out there and just overcome those things, just the satisfaction from overcoming them just day by day, or even, you know, moment by moment, can be really, really, really rewarding. You just got to get out there and do it. But it's so much easier to say than do.
It is. It really is. And one thing that has helped me in the past is, because I've had struggles with depression, which can actually really hamper your drive to get out and go there, because it's so much easier to just stay inside and use escapism to clear your head during that sort of thing. But I was introduced to a concept, I believe it was from a Navy SEAL. I can't remember who exactly. Somebody would be able to maybe comment on the Instagram post if they remember themselves who it was, but they had a 15-minute rule. And they said that no matter what sort of situation you're in, whether it's your brain or your obligations or weather or whatever it is, whatever the excuse, you can do something for 15 minutes. And that's the only obligation that you have. You only have one thing to do, and that is to do that thing for 15 minutes. And more often than not, especially if you do this regularly, you know, every day that you would normally do that thing, you do it for at least 15 minutes. More often than not, and more regularly as you keep doing this, you'll find that you'll start with the intention of doing it for 15 minutes, but then you'll end up doing it for half an hour. And then maybe the next time it might be for an hour. And eventually you'll just rediscover the love for it, and it'll just become rhythm. It's a little bit like jogging. If you've never jogged before, the first time you go out to do a jog is just hell. You just feel awful doing it. And you'll maybe only go for, you know, a few meters before you're wheezing and lying on the ground trying to catch your breath. But if you just keep doing it every day, you go out and you try jogging again, within 2 weeks, you'll be just jogging around the block. It's just your body gets used to it. Your brain gets used to it. And after a while, you start getting those dopamine hits from doing it, because your body starts going, yeah, we're in its routine, it's good. And it usually only takes 2 weeks, but if you can just invest 15 minutes and promise yourself that no matter what happens, you'll do 15 minutes, I guarantee you it'll keep working. It'll just get better and better as you keep going. And then you've only got one thing that you have to try and do, and that is to do 15 minutes.
It goes from I feel like I'm going to throw up to I feel amazing and I love doing this and I need more of this in my life.
Oh, absolutely. It's crazy. And our bodies want to be working properly, and our brains want to be working properly. It's like, you know, air follows the path of least resistance, and so does your mind and your body and your soul. So it's, you just got to sometimes show it that there are easier ways. But
I really like that. 15 minutes. That's great.
One thing I will say, Eduardo, is that it does depend whether or not you're doing this for your job or whether or not this is a sort of a weekend warrior hobby sort of thing. What Kyle said about getting people in on it is very valid. If you are just doing this on weekends and that sort of thing, get a mate over who forges, or even somebody who doesn't forge. Say, hey, do you want to have a day in the forge with me? And they'll probably say, hell yeah, because you know, if they weren't excited about forging, you don't need that kind of negativity in your life. Cut them off. but having somebody there and showing them the ropes and everything, seeing it's kind of like, as I got older, I found that Christmas wasn't as exciting. And I said to my dad once, you know, does Christmas ever get exciting? And he goes, yeah, when you have kids, because you can see how exciting it is for them. And then all of a sudden it's exciting again. If you are getting burnt out on forging, watching somebody forge for the first time, you see the excitement again. And you have to watch over them because they'll burn themselves or set fire to your workshop or something. So it's a really great way to sort of keep you going.
Yeah, that's a great tip for sure.
Yeah. And also, as somebody who did quit their day job and move to full time, if you are a weekend warrior, look at what you're doing during the week. If you're so burnt out at the end of your week that on the weekends your body's telling you need to rest and you don't have the energy to do things, maybe reconsider what you're doing during the week. It might not be healthy for you if you're that burnt out on weekends. But that's just a jab from the perspective of somebody who left a large career that was burning him out. It can lead to bad things if you're doing something that is hitting you that hard.
Mm-hmm. So. And I could also mention there's like a really big difference between trying to make a hobby into your full-time job and then just trying to keep something a hobby. I immediately took knife making and was like, wanted to make it a full-time job right away. But you gotta, if you do that, go into it with the understanding that it's going to feel different than if you play guitar or something and you don't really care about putting food on the table and you're just in it for fun and you can just enjoy it that way. You're going to have these different pressures if you're doing it full time that you're going to need to look at and try to overcome, because things can get really monotonous sometimes. And it doesn't mean you don't enjoy what you do, but it means you might have to push through whatever these certain circumstances are at the time in order to get to the stuff you really like. It's just kind of different.
It hobby still means and full time's different. Else.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully that gives you some inspiration, Eduardo, and put the forge cast on while you're working, and then you'll be hearing about forging while forging.
There you go.
And the Forgecast playlist will give you some jams to listen to. So our next email comes from Ben, and he says, "Hi guys, love the podcast. I recently have been working on a knife where I had to solder a brass bolster to a 1095 blade. I used paste flux and lead-free solder from the hardware store. It created a strong joint. This got me thinking, can you use any kind of solder to join brass and steel? Is there a preferable kind of solder? What about steel and copper? Or what if I wanted to join Mokumagane to steel? Basically, what are the best practices and limitations of soldering in knife making? Thanks for making a great podcast. Love your intro and outro music. Ben Dysart." It's a good question. And it's a very versatile skill to be able to solder. But I wanted to point out there is a difference between soldering and brazing and the attaching a non-ferrous metal to a ferrous metal is a process called brazing. You can also solder them, but they are two very different processes. And depending on the material that you're working with, one or the circumstances around doing that attachment, one may be preferable to the other.
What if you have a non-ferrous metal? You're joining two ferrous metals with a non-ferrous metal. Is that brazing?
Such as cumai?
I was thinking of on the end of my tangs, I would do this high temperature solder or braze between the end of the tang and like a bolt.
If there's no solder involved, then that's a braze.
Okay.
Yeah. Solder is sort of like a filler material that acts as an intermediary that's sticky to both. Almost like putting glue in there, but it works that sort of way. So using quality silver solder, if you are soldering, is going to make a difference. It's one of those. There are awesome tools out there that you can buy cheap and it'll work fine. And you know don't believe the hype. Some things you can get away with cheap. Solder is not one of those things, unfortunately. There is a direct proportion to how good quality your solder is to how good results you're going to get in the join if you're soldering. And also choosing the right flux. Different fluxes are designed for different materials. And you talk about joining Mokimagane. What type of Mokimagane? It could be silver and copper. It could be brass and nickel. It could be nickel and silver. It could be all sorts of wonderful things. There are so many combinations. It could be three or four types of material in the Mokimagane. So depending on what material is in there, I'd probably opt for soldering there, because a good quality silver solder will attach to all of those materials. And it will do so at about the same rate, but the temperatures that you have to get them to is going to be different. So one of the things when anyone who's dabbled with Mokimagane and tried to make copper brass Mokimagane gets a front row seat to how different brass works at copper brazing temperature. it just does not want to behave. It will, under impact, it will literally just splatter. So certain things have to be done very carefully. One thing I would recommend if you are going to silver solder is it's a process called tinning. So you coat each mating surface. So one on the steel, one on the Mokimagane or bolster or copper or brass. You actually coat it with a thin layer of solder. So you prep the surface, you clean it, and you actually give it a thin coat. And then you put those two pieces together, clamp them, and then heat the solder. And as the solder of both sides liquefies inside, the clamping pressure will push down, pushing out the excess, and it will be pre-soldered, is sort of just add heat.
You don't have to worry about it like running all the way underneath the part to the other side or anything, because it's already in there.
Yeah, and one really good pro tip, if you want to stop your solder from getting somewhere on a part, get a graphite pencil and rub it all over the place where you don't want solder to go. If you've ever seen hydrophobic surfaces where water just beads and rolls off them, graphite is sort of like hydrophobic to solder. So it won't stick to any surface that's covered in graphite.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's really cool.
So let's say a really good example is if you had a folder liner, like you were making a nice classic slip joint and you were silver soldering a brass bolster to it, and you didn't want that solder to run out across the rest of the handle liner because that would inhibit your wooden scales going on there, and you want a nice clean line, then you can sort of clamp your bolster in place to find where it needs to be, line it up with any pinholes or anything, and then use it as a template to actually just get a pencil, just a lead pencil, and color in the brass, and you'll notice that the solder will not flow past where the graphite is.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. If you're doing a braze, however, you don't need solder at all. Flux is still very important, and the right type of flux for the material. This is all sort of freely available online, what flux works with what material, but the key thing that will inhibit a braze is oxygen, and that's the purpose of the flux. It actually creates a little shield that the oxygen can't reach the surface. Oxygen just creates oxides on metals. In real time, you can watch it happen. You can have highly polished brass, and if you've left it highly polished, it won't take long before it looks dull. And that's oxides forming, and those oxides will inhibit a braze. So hopefully that helps.
That's super good. I don't have much to add at all on low temperature, like soldering guards and stuff, because I've only done a tiny little bit of it, and it was 15 years ago on like some of my very first knives. all of my soldering experience is all with high temperatures, like silver solders that are like 12 and 1500 degrees that you probably don't want to use to solder a guard to a 1095 blade with. But all I would say is just clean and good quality flux.
Yeah. Good quality flux and good quality solder make all the difference. It's really good. I really like waxy fluxes just because I find them a little bit more versatile. I use them even in places where you're not supposed to really use a waxy flux, but if you should always use only as much flux as you need. A lot of people say just cover the whole thing with flux, but it's just a mess if you do that, and you can actually create pockets where the solder won't reach. Solder at temperature wicks beautifully. into places where you would never expect it to wick. But if that space is creates a little vacuum pocket filled with flux, then the solder can't wick in there. So be sparing with it.
Yeah.
Hopefully that helps, Ben. And our final email comes from Jerry Previtt, and he sent us an article about the unfortunate passing of Randy Dack, a locally beloved blacksmith from the Sturr Museum in Nebraska. And he says, "Hi, not sure if you guys do shout-outs, but this is the man I took my first class with, and seeing him at Sturr Museum as a child has always fed my love for this craft, and he will be missed dearly." So our condolences go out for the passing of Randy. It's unfortunate to hear, but yeah, perhaps if you did know Randy or knew of him, drop a comment below and tell us the story of how you knew him, because that sort of thing helps keep him alive. So hard question time, Kyle. Are we going to see you with this year's 48-hour dagger challenge?
That is such a cool challenge. I have watched, like, the last years, I watched it really, really well. I watched maybe not everybody that did it, but I was following so many different people doing it. It was so cool. And I was like, I maybe need to get in on this. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm sleeping right now while these guys are working, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's quite cool that sometimes having the time difference, because it starts at lunchtime on the starting date, regardless of where you live, and it goes for 48 hours from then. So it's really good because I get to finish my 48 hours because I'm ahead of South Africa where Niels is, and I get to then sit and relax and watch these guys do their final few hours. And it's good, but you do, especially if you're full time, you have to plan for it, because they say it's a 48 hour challenge, but it really, cause it starts at lunchtime, it goes over 3 days and it is exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting. So you do have to plan for it in advance, but, it will teach you things about yourself and your processes and your knowledge that even you didn't know.
Well, when I was thinking about coming on the podcast yesterday, I was thinking, as I was eating lunch, I was like thinking about the 48-hour challenge and thinking that I just take so long at doing things. But then I was like, I should do stuff like that because it would help in other aspects to go through things quickly.
Yeah.
And it would make those things that take longer, if I did that more often, it would make some of those things actually faster and not take so long if I just flip that switch and have a completely different attitude about what I'm making, you know?
Because that's the beauty of it. I mean, it's not really a competition. You don't get judged. There's no rankings at the end of it. It's just the satisfaction of doing it and being on that literally world stage. And you get these beautiful insights into these different people's work processes, and it teaches you things about your own. I mean, not last year, but the year before, I competed in it, and I made just a simple Fairbairn Sykes dagger because I thought, I'm going to go simple. It's nice and easy to do. I was still working right up until about 15 minutes to go to get it finished. And then I finished and sat down at my computer and watched Niels Vandenberg do more work in the last 20 minutes than I had done in the entire 48 hours. Just because his processes are so refined, his workshop's so beautifully laid out, and I realized I've got to change how I'm making knives.
That's hilarious. Oh, it would be really fun. When is it coming up?
He doesn't know an exact date yet, but he is going to be doing it sometime in August. So you've got time to prepare. And as soon as he knows a date, he's going to be announcing it so people can plan and prep for it.
August. Okay. It might be really fun. I don't know. But so, I don't know. With me, competitions, I don't do well.
Well, you're only competing against yourself.
Yeah, but that's like... I mean, to think, if there's a timer, it's some kind of competition, and I would just instantly, when that starts, this mode changes inside of me, and I've done some little 3-hour things. We're trying to kind of copy Forge and Fire stuff here in the shop, the Joshua video or whatever years ago, and it just, I don't know if I can handle it. It's just, I let stuff like that stress me out too much, but it would be a good learning experience and growing experience.
Consider this. The first time I entered it, I had never made a dagger before.
Really?
Never done a dagger grind.
Oh, man.
And I still finished. So if little old me can do it, I'm pretty sure you can. I see a calendar behind you. You just cross off all of August and just...
all of August.
Yeah, just say to be advised.
That's the big empty calendar, the one with all the stuff on it's over there.
Right.
No, I really would like to. We'll see. I'll talk to the family about it. I think it would make a great YouTube video, or maybe a couple YouTube videos possibly too.
I agree. We actually had Alex Steele join in last year, which was great. And he did a video about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the other big event that's coming up, obviously, is Blade Show.
Yes.
Will you be heading there?
Yeah, I'm going to Blade Show, the one in Atlanta.
Yes. Who are you looking forward to catching up with the most?
Oh, boy.
I mean, it's been a long time of isolation and events being canceled, and I'm sure you've been fanging to catch up with everybody.
Probably looking forward to catching up with people that I don't even know. It might be strange to say, but people I don't even know or maybe have met once or twice at previous shows, probably looking forward to catching up with them the most and meeting them, just because every year when I go to Blade Show now, since doing YouTube and everything, there's so many people that seem to know so much about me, but I don't know anything about them. So Blade Show is like one of my main opportunities to actually meet a small fraction of people and just interact with them in person and stuff, instead of it just being over the internet. So that's probably one of the main things I look forward to, as far as meeting people there and talking with all these different people.
Yep. Yeah, people don't usually choose knife making as a career if they're an extrovert. So going to shows like that and having to talk to everybody and have people see your work in person, that and you're across from someone like Jerry Fisk or Steve Schwarzer, who you're just sort of trembling, thinking, "Oh God, are they going to notice all the things that I can see that nobody else seems to be able to see?" Yeah.
And this past Blade Show, like, I got moved up to Jerry Fisk's old table.
Oh,
and
wow.
Even that just made me feel really nervous for some reason. I'm like, I felt like I had to bring an extra high level of something just to kind of fill the shoes of the legend that was at that table, you know, that made me. But when I first started going to shows, I would get terrified.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrified about presenting my work in front of all my peers and all the people that were way better than me, and just having my work visible for all to see and come by. And I would throw up. The morning before a show, I would throw up in the hotel because I was so crazy nervous to show up there.
Well, when you make this your whole life, I mean, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, knife making is how we live.
Mm-hmm. It did terrify me for years, but thankfully I've been able to get over that to where I don't get sick before I go to the show.
Well, that's always a plus. You've taken some great projects to Blade Shows in the past, and because living on my tiny little island on the other side of the planet, all I can do for Blade Show is just watch the live feeds and the social media posts and things like that. And it's always great seeing the best work of the best knife makers on show up close, being talked about by the people who made them. It's just incredible. You've made some very memorable things over the years. What has been your favorite project that you've ever made?
My favorite project.
I know you had a lot of fun with Excelsior.
Yeah, that was definitely the most grand. You know, sometimes I feel like I tell my family this, but I don't like say it publicly probably, but I always feel like my favorite project is the next one that I'm working on. The one I'm currently working on, at least until I get to that stage when like things aren't going so well and everything just slows down to a halt, then maybe it's not my favorite. But I do normally feel like the next thing I'm doing is my favorite, or anytime I get to do something new and different. But as far as like past pieces I've done, the swords, I mean, they're in their own category. I don't want to just say, oh, my sword, because it was like the biggest, fanciest thing. But I really enjoyed the piece I brought to Blade Show last year. It was out of the ordinary for me, this big, long, curvy, kind of Persian-y style blade. I had a mosaic Damascus made with pure nickel in it. Never done that before. I had a curvy handle fit up and pommel. Never done that before. Just normally do flat pieces against a flat piece. So I really enjoyed that one for some of the new things it had.
You talk about your favorite one being the next project. Do you have some sort of pie in the sky dream project that one day you're hoping to build, something that you've been just sort of percolating for a while and still trying to work out how you'd pull it off?
Well, I mentioned it earlier, stainless steel Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really want to get into that and possibly have it be on my really high-end pieces. But I kind of have this picture of Buster Werenski daggers. I love his work, super like art knife style, lots of embellishments. A lot of times they have stone handles and stuff. I want to get into doing stone handles and doing these really artsy daggers and buoys and stuff, and moving more into like that kind of style. It's kind of what I picture is my high in the pie or high in the sky kind of thing that I'm shooting for.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll get there, but that's kind of where I'm at now.
Oh, you're young yet. I hear some of these knife makers, like Steve Schwarzer, who we mentioned before, have been doing it for longer than we've been alive.
Yeah.
And I have no intention of changing career paths. I'm pretty sure you wouldn't either. So you never know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, never know where it'll go. And that's part of the exciting part, too, is like, where you think you're going to go changes so constant. Like every couple of years, you can kind of see that goal like moving around and like shifting as you influence the direction of your work, as other people influence it. Mm-hmm. And it all just kind of comes together in this cool way.
I remember when we last spoke, I was doing purely artisanal blacksmithing work. I'd not even really made a knife. And now making folding knives is my full-time job.
It's that's crazy.
If you'd said that to me back then, I would have told you you're nuts.
So what's your like pie in the sky, the thing that you're shooting for, that you kind of have this vision of that you might want to head towards?
No, you're interviewing me now. I really, as much as I cop a lot of flack from this from Niels, but I like projects where I don't necessarily have a strict plan. I have no sketches. And I like to sort of feel what the knife needs next. And every time usually I plan my projects and I make templates and all that sort of thing. But every so often I'll just do an art piece. I just recently finished one. It was a automatic switchblade that was one of those. And I'm just making the liners and it's like, they need to be coined. And I'm looking at examples of coining, and then I'd see the work of Delana, who does stunning work. And she'd turn this tiny edge of these liners into little squares the entire way around. I'm like, that's beautiful. I got to try that. And what my goal is really is not so much a specific project, but to get my... doing it full time, there's a certain amount of my day that has to be reserved to making the money to live and get by. But to be able to sort of get myself ahead enough where I can just put aside, I'm talking like a solid 3 or 4 months where I can just give myself over to a project and make it what it needs to be in my head. And it's those projects that teach me the most. The things that starting a project that I know that at the beginning of the project, I don't know how I'm going to finish it. I don't know how to do it, but knowing that I will. And so in that process, I'll learn more and it will influence all subsequent knives. I actually have one of those projects on the go right now. It's on a hiatus at the moment because Australia during summer goes into full fire ban mode. But I'm making a musketeer-style rapier that is one of the more difficult types of sword to make if you're making a functional one. And heat treating it, I want to do it period accurate, the heat treatment.
Yeah.
Which is going to take
What does that
fire.
Look like? What's the period accurate?
A trench forge with a hand crank blower.
Oh, and you're talking about this kind of knife or sword has a really like super skinny, long, thin blade, right?
You know, like the Three Musketeers where it's very whippy and they've got the big basket hilt wrapped around the hand, all ornate. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also going to be, I don't have the budget to do gold inlay, but I'm going to be doing Nordic gold inlay, because on the, it's called the forte of the blade, the strongest part up just above the handle. I'm actually going to be engraving on one side all for one, and then on the other side and one for all, but in French, and then doing Nordic gold inlay. So it's,
what's Nordic gold?
Nordic gold is a sort of like a faux gold. It's a copper alloy, but it's got, I believe, tin, zinc, antimony, and copper, I believe, I think.
Okay.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's what Scandinavian currency is actually made from. But
really?
It has a very, very long history of the Nordic culture of making it. And it looks... It's sort of like... they call brass poor man's gold. Brass does not shine like gold does. No matter what you do, brass just does not look as good as gold. Nordic gold is kind of like the halfway point between brass and real gold.
Nice.
It's beautiful. It polishes up incredibly. It has this very subtle rose tone to it that you get in gold. That sort of the way the light hits it in a sort of reddish glint sometimes. It's it's a gorgeous material and something that you can make yourself if you can get the tin. Tin is hard to get in pure form. But thanks to my boy Sam Towns, he sent me a couple of ingots of it, and I'm very much looking forward to putting that in there. So doing a rapier at all when I've only ever made one sword is a ridiculous task, and I had no idea what I was going to do. But even unheat treated, because the whole blade's made out of SUP 9, which is the Australian equivalent of 5160. Just from the grind profile, it has incredible flex. You can just bend this thing like it's made of plastic, and it hasn't been heat treated yet, and it snaps back to its original shape. But the tip is still left thick because it's such a delicate tip. I don't want to put that through in its final shape through such a barbaric heat treatment process. But
so basically, if you survive the heat treat, like, you should be golden. The heat treat's going to be the biggest question mark, huh?
Well, that would be the case until I tell you that probably 90% of the work's going to be in the incredibly ornate basket hilt. I want it to be something that's just magnificent, something that you could just keep looking at and keep seeing detail from. Every one of the coils that forms the basket hilt is going to actually have twisted file work on it, and it's sort of semi planned out in my head, but it's going to be one of those projects that just evolve over time. But the blade has been sat there in my workshop in the corner waiting for the fire bands to finish so that I can continue on with the project.
But that sounds amazing.
We're coming up to autumn now, or you call it fall, and that usually signals the end of it, so people should start seeing that build a bit more.
That'll be so cool. Have you cut into the blade yet for the inlay? Done any of the cutting?
No. What I want to actually try, the recent folding Bowie knife that I made was for a competition. There was an international Bowie competition that was hosted by Sam Towns, and the first prize was a full engraving set. I mean like 40 pieces and the hammer of every type of Japanese style engraver that there is. Wow. And I won first place with that folding Bowie. And so I have this engraver set. So I've got to get some practice in before I do anything with it. I've done engraving before. I have an extremely limited graving set, and I've done work with engraving. My last sword, it was a Viking sword, had runes all the way down either side of the bevels of the blade, either side of the fuller. And it was for a wedding, and it was the surnames of the two, the bride and the groom, in Viking runes. And that taught me quite a lot about engraving and refined my process quite a bit. What I'm wanting to engrave on the rapier is much simpler, fewer characters, and I just got to make sure I get the French right, because it would be awful if I... It's like, you know, you see these people who get tattoos and there's a spelling error. It's like one of those. But I have a few friends in France that can help me with that, I think.
Yeah, that's good. Google Translate could be dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. Speaking of challenges, I know the listeners will be very excited to find out what our latest ForgeCast competition is. So last month, you guys had to make a single piece set of snips, and you did some amazing ones, including Steve at Alien Monkey Blacksmith, who did a set out of Kumai, which is just extra as hell, and I approve. But our new competition, we put out a teaser last week when we were talking to Niels, that you need to partner up, that it's going to be teams of two. You don't necessarily have to be physically present. You can mail this to each other. But this is the episode where we announce what the competition is. Now, you have 2 months to do this. It's going to go all the way until the end of April. And there are prizes, first, second, and third prizes, which will be announced later. But you actually have freedom of design. I want a collaborative project where you can make anything you want, but it must be something whimsical, because the world needs more whimsy right now. So think silly but beautiful inventions like Uri Tuchman would make, or kinetic sculptures, or perhaps something with a clockwork mechanism that's its sole purpose is just to make someone smile or laugh. So this is just competition of form, not function. We don't want useful things. We want whimsical things, just silly things, but it's a collaborative effort. So we were going to just do a clean slate. You can make whatever you want as a collaborative project and we just judge you on its awesomeness. But we know that different people have different means. They have different amounts of spare time. They have different tooling available to them. So you will be judged purely on your whimsy.
Wow, that sounds like a really good topic, like a good setting for something creative and fun.
Yeah, there are so many cool things out there that as examples of things that have no purpose in life, they have no function, they don't benefit your life in any other way except just making you smile when you see them.
Mm-hmm.
So that is your competition. Now, you're going to be working in teams of two. You can either work together if you live nearby, or if you need to, you can, one person could be working on one part of it, the other person could be working on another. You can mail it between each other to do the final assembly, but we need to see the contributions from two people. If you want to add more people in, we won't say no, but it's got to be a minimum of two people, and you will be judged solely on the whimsy of the finished product. So. And there will be prizes, first, second, and third. The prizes, as always, will be provided by Ryan at Otway Fiddleback, and it'll probably be stabilized handle blocks. He has some of the most beautifully chatoyant Australian woods that you can get, beautifully stabilized by Dean at Reclaim Creative. So
Australia's got some beautiful wood too.
Oh, we do. And where I live in Tasmania has very famous woods with our Tasmanian blackwood Blackheart sassafras. You'll have to let me know if you ever want any, Kyle. I'll send you some.
Blackheart sassafras? Is that what you said?
Blackheart sassafras, yeah. It's
haven't heard of that one.
The groves of trees are over 10,000 years old, and they form their own sort of fungal systems in the wood that spread throughout the wood, creating these weird flowing black lines all the way through it. And then the tree falls down and it sort of hardens in that state as the fungus dies off, and it creates just works of art in each tree. It's incredible.
Wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, you'll have to let me know if you want some direct from the source. But if people want to get in on that competition, you'll just have to show a bit of your progress and the final thing using the hashtag ForgeCastCompetition. And that's what you want to do. Last time, a lot of you were still using the ForgeCast Challenge hashtag. This is a competition this time. So hashtag ForgeCast Competition. I look forward to your whimsy. Hopefully it gives many people a lot of smiles when they see what people are coming up with. So can be
anything. That's going to be awesome. I might have to talk to Dad about this. I have somebody right in my own shop that I could collaborate with.
Yeah, there you go. That'd be great to see. But yeah, it's been awesome talking to you today, Kyle. Thanks so much for coming onto the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Alex. I had a great time.
If people, for some strange reason, are not following you, where can they find you?
They can find me on YouTube, Kyle mm-hmm. Royer Knives, and Instagram at Kyle Royer Knives. And yep. yeah, those are the two main places right there.
And where can they get access to your wonderful courses and Knife Maker Plus and such?
Yeah, all the courses and Knife Maker Plus are on learnknifemaking.com.
Brilliant.
That simple. That's it.
I've checked out your website. I used to work in a lot of web design and marketing, and it's beautifully laid out. Really, really nicely done.
Oh, thanks. I'll tell Josh about that. He works on that, and he's always like feeling like kind of down on what he's doing with it, and feels like he wants to do more but doesn't know what to do and stuff. I'll tell him you said that.
Yeah, it's great. I approve. Tell him some random guy in Tasmania approves. Well, as always, people, if you want to send in your questions, blacksmithing, bladesmithing, whatever it is, metallurgy questions, send them on through to ask.forgecast@gmail.com and we'll answer them on the show. And if you're looking for us, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Just look for Forgecast. And if you're looking for me, I go by Valhalla Ironworks, and you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And we'll see you all next week. Thanks again, Carl.
Yeah, thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I don't know what I'm doing.